live at ACB 2010. This is Michael Off, and I caught up with Nancy Miracle. That's her name. I bet you get harassed about that one a lot. Or
I do.
Yeah, I bet.
I do, and my daughter will tell you, if we told you how we got it, we'd have to kill you. But the truth is it came with my husband in the usual sort of way, and he got it from his daddy.
Well, you certainly have created a miracle product for many, and let's talk about Digit Eyes. That's Digit-Eyes, and what this product does for your iPhone.
Well, it's a product that runs on your iPhone, and actually, as of about the end of the month, we're releasing for the Android as well. And what it does is it allows you to use your smartphone as a scanner. And there's really three contexts in which we think this is useful. The obvious one, which everybody thinks about, is I'd really like to scan manufacturer's codes. We do that reasonably well. It's a difficult thing to learn in some senses because the manufacturers really don't put the codes in a place that are very convenient to humans. And there's a learning curve where you have to figure out how the manufacturer thought where they placed the code. The other two functions, which we think are both interesting and extremely useful, are ones that are associated with creating your own labels. In the one case, you use inexpensive Avery address labels, and you print a barcode on them that your phone can read, and that allows you to record whatever you might like in terms of information to go with that code. In the second case, what you do is, presuming you know what you're going to be labeling, you simply type what you'd like to have in that barcode, and we go ahead and put that in the code, and your phone reads it back to you using the standard voiceover methodologies.
Oh, nice. So you can customize the labels. You get to associate the barcode with your own typewritten text that prints out on your printer.
Yes. It's actually not really typewritten. That's a little bit of a misnomer. I probably didn't describe it well. What the codes really look like is they're about an inch square, and they look a lot like a box that's full of black and white sand with maybe some little targets at the corners. But your phone doesn't know that, and the phone doesn't have any problem with it. The phone just reads them and turns those back into text. So if, for instance, I was labeling maybe a bunch of strawberry jam, I type Nancy strawberry jam, June 2010, and then when I scanned it, VoiceOver would simply voice that.
So you could actually create your own then for things that might not have barcodes by default.
Yes. One of the things that happens with barcoded items is as soon as they're unwrapped, they're often unlabeled also, because the wrapping will come off and the barcode comes off with them. There's also things that have never been labeled, which is very useful to know what it is. A good example is I know one of our testers wanted to label the household papers so that in the event that, you know, somebody had to access them, it was clear which was the mortgage, which was the deeds to the car, which was the wills, that kind of stuff. They simply created text labels that said exactly what they were, when they were dated, and then they stuck them on the documents.
Right. Same with multimedia, CDs, and, you know, discs and other items. So the sky's the limit with the labels, but just the codes themselves. I mean, you have your own database, I guess, what, a couple million? How many barcodes do you have to work with?
Well, in terms of UPC codes, that turned out to be one of the unexpected and perhaps most surprising portions of the development. We had innocently thought that there would be some sort of public database where we could go and look these up. And most of the databases we found were small, a million records or less. And there are tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of consumer products in the United States and worldwide. And to be able to provide reasonable coverage, we had to get these. So what happened was, having explored all the available data sources, it turned out that we were going to have to build our own database. And that's fortunate because one of my fields especially is search methodologies. And I did the host side on this. So we ended up having to do software that would do robotic examination across the internet and look for UPC and what's called EAN codes, which are the European article number, which is like a UPC but for Europe, and to find the titles of those items. So we currently have about 7.5 million codes in the database, and the database is growing by about 250,000 records per week.
Wow. It's pretty substantial.
There's a lot of consumer products out there. I mean, we have not only foods, but you'll find things like makeup, pharmaceuticals, clothing, shoes, toys, obviously the usual sort of books and records, and perhaps even more unexpectedly, I guess, the things like detergents, tools, screws, nuts, bolts, all those kind of things. Because all of those have barcodes on them, And there's times when you need to know what they are.
Wow, that I hadn't even thought about that aspect of it. That could be very helpful. You get to get the right size screws for your device, wood, metal, whatever, without having to open up the boxes and so forth.
Right. And that, obviously, if you've purchased those, you can put your own labels on it. One of the things, for instance, I'm a knitter. So, and if you're not a knitter, you probably don't appreciate this problem. But when you start knitting and you use a ball of yarn, the first thing that happens is the manufacturer's ID, which is a sort of wrapper that goes around it, falls off because you've used up some of the yarn. One of the things that's handy, of course, is to stick one of these labels on the end of the yarn that you're not knitting and say, this is color A from my pattern for a Argyle sweater, and it was lion wool color dark blue. And then when you finish and there's some of that stuff left over, what you do is you do what all knitters do, and you put it in your stash and you save it, and then you can come back a year from now, scan it with your phone, and find out what that stuff is. And then you can make something nice like a hat for Christmas. It just takes a little bit of yarn.
Awesome. Nancy, what brought you and your husband and your whole family to this? I mean, what led you to this?
Actually, knitting. I was in I'm an online knitting group, and I got there because in my real life, I'm a full-time professional software developer. I have my own company, and one of my clients is Lion Brand Yarn. And it's been very important to us to make sure that website was accessible. And as a result, I participate in a number of knitting groups for people who are low vision and not sighted. And one of the ladies in the knitting group was explaining to me that her color detector had broken. And innocent that I am, I said, so what's a color detector? And she explained to me, and then she started explaining to me some of the other pieces of hardware she had. She had a scanner, she had a labeler. And some of the other ladies started chiming in and explaining they had a recorder and many other different devices. And then they started explaining to me that these devices were often broken, lost, batteries run down, they were fragile. And it sort of turned into a sort of general session that was very educational about the fragility of adaptive hardware and the fact that it was often in a different room where you wanted it. And I thought to myself, you know, this is wrong. This is just wrong. I'm a software developer. This could be on a single platform. And there's no reason it shouldn't be. So I went and talked to a couple of friends of mine and said, you know, this is a project we really should do. And these people are telling me that they spend $2,000, $3,000, sometimes $4,000 each to buy the stuff. I think we can do it for a whole lot less. So we're talking about this, and you're trying to decide what we could do. I thought, well, you know, we could do it for 10%. And one of my buddies said, nah, that's wrong. Let's try for 1%. 10% is not aggressive enough. And that was really our design target, was to get a general purpose device, which is why we picked the iPhone and the Android phone, that we could go ahead and put the software on and economically sell it for 1% of the price that people would pay for special purpose hardware. Because I really think that it's a good thing to have one device where you can take your notes, where you can record, where you can have your talking calculator, your talking clock, and of course, digitize.
So you sound like you kind of agree with us, our philosophy at Cyril Talk and Cyril Tech, that when possible, there should be some mainstream economical solutions, and that maybe even these rehab systems, before they just go throwing down $6,000 for a note taker, look and see, hey, maybe the iPhone can do everything they need and more.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And I think you'll find there's a lot of research that agrees with you, too. I've been talking to some of my buddies at the VA who've been doing research on device abandonment. And what happens often is, and they found this looking at the devices that they've bought for people, is about 2 years down the road, most of those devices are on the shelf someplace. They're broken, they're obsolete, the batteries are gone, they stopped working somehow, and they've been abandoned. The thing about a phone is it has multiple purposes. The point about manufacturing phones is that they're manufactured in very large volume, so it's easier to get the manufacturing cost out of them. These are cost efficiencies that you get running a million devices that you just don't get when you're running 1,000. And you can put the engineering in to make the device extremely robust. Okay, so it won't end up broken, might end up lost. But it probably isn't going to end up abandoned because it has many functions, it's convenient, it fits in your pocket, so it's not someplace else when you need to use it. And one of the things that's really nice about it is it doesn't set you apart as a blind person.
I think that's very important. I didn't realize that until going to a major event of my peers and them all saying, well, how does that device work? There's no screen on it, and realizing that that signals you out, and if you can use what everyone else does, it just helps you integrate. And the iPhone is, all the latest Apple products have been such a icebreaker. There's people amazed that you can use the iPhone and, you know, could open up so many doors of opportunity, be it employment or anything else, when we're all using the same technology. And as you said, worst case scenario, 2 years from now, you spend $200 and get a new phone, but you have the latest technology and you're not paying a dime more than any sighted person. I really admire and commend the work that you're doing here.
I appreciate it. You know, it's one of those things. Being blind is very inconvenient. It should not also, in my estimation, be very expensive.
Exactly, exactly. So how much is Digit Eyes for folks that would like to pursue this?
It's $29.99, and that's $29.99.
That's right. Hear that right, folks. 29.95. There you go.
Right. You get it just by going to the iTunes store. When you get the Android version, you'll be getting it by going to the Android store. It will be priced the same there.
So what do you have in the future for Digit Eyes? Where are you going with it?
Well, we're looking at adding additional functionality. We are currently in the process of soliciting beta testers for the additional version of this that does color detection.
Wow. That would be a very useful feature. And, of course, there's always challenges. Do you have any tips for people in just scanning?
I do. One of the things you might want to do is go to our website, because we have a fairly extensive section that describes issues about scanning. The ability to scan is obviously predicated on the ability of your device to recognize the difference between black and white. Okay, because their barcodes are typically black and white barcodes. The goodness, if you will, of any barcode recognizing system is going to be ultimately dependent on the database. The mechanics of recognizing barcodes are fairly straightforward. You want to go ahead and, for instance, with our device and with most of them, you want to start up close to it, okay, and you want to move away from it, because you have to understand that it's going to get into the focal length of the camera. If you're using a non-visible light scanner, one of them, for instance, that is a laser scanner, those work a little bit different, and you'll have a different capture rate. But in general, what you have to do is make sure, if you're scanning a manufacturer's item, get a good guess about where it is, take your scanning device, whether it's a laser scanner or a visible light scanner, and then rotate the object in front of it until you can get a capture.
Now, my son just texted me all excited about his new iPhone 4. Are there advantages to having this versus the 3GS because of its flash and improved camera?
Yes, absolutely. The version that will be released around the end of the month here by us utilizes the flash. Right now, what happens is we warn you if you're in a dark place. We say insufficient light to scan. But we can't do anything about it because we don't have a flash on the 3GS, and we didn't interface to the flash on the 4 because at the time we released the product, Apple had not released the API, which would allow us to program for it. We will be using that as of the end of the month on our new release.
Well, I'm very excited. I've been very impressed with the product, and why don't you give your contact information?
Sure. The easiest way to get us is to go to our website, which is, mysteriously, www.digit-eyes, that's digit-eyes.com. We have a contact link that is prominently located, and the easiest thing to do is simply to click that. If we're not at a show, which we are, of course, today, we typically get back to you within an hour. Otherwise, we'll get back to you within a day.
Very good. One final question. I know you're busy here with the event. What would you suggest, as many of us now try to approach software developers, maybe they made an iPhone app, but just really haven't had accessibility or voiceover in mind, what might be a great way to approach them and make them realize, hey, there are 3 million of us out here in the U.S. alone, and to think about accessibility, and, you know, not just for the goodwill factor, that we are a market?
Well, actually, coding on the iPhone for accessible applications is extremely easy. If somebody hasn't coded for it, it's a little surprising to me. You can certainly refer them to us, and I'll be happy to talk to them and explain it to them. But ultimately, you know, people develop software because they think there's a market there, and you say, hey, look, you're missing a huge amount of your market, and it's easy to program for. It's just going to take a few little extra things, and you should do it.
And plus, Apple has a great resource as well, so between the two, certainly take you up on that. If someone asks, needs a referral, that's great. We like to see software developers working together. Nancy, thank you very much for your time. I hope everyone owning a device will check out this product and support your efforts, because this really is the future. And anytime we can bring mainstream access, that's the world is a better place. Thank you very much. Live from ACB 2010, the SaroTalk.com podcast, this is Michael Love.